So we come on the evening of Easter Day to the account of what happened in the afternoon and evening of that first Easter Day, which I think is quite appropriate. Not that we have to tie in our sermon subjects with the date that they first happened. The clergy and readers were discussing possible sermon series in a recent meeting, and the question was raised, do we or should we preach about Pentecost on Pentecost Sunday? And Ian said that it wasn't absolutely necessary to do that. And he was quite right. We don't have to follow the biblical calendar any more than we have to, say, preach from Ruth at harvest time. And yet Easter is when we do most likely align our teaching with the original date. Easter follows the timing of Passover and the phase of the moon. That's why it's a movable feast, despite the sporadic efforts of the educational establishment to fix the date. And I noticed they've been making noises about that recently. I wonder how many Easter eggs you've eaten today. There was something in the paper about a doctor from South Suffolk and Northeast Essex saying that we shouldn't eat an Easter egg all in one go. South Suffolk and Northeast Essex Health Authority was where Robin and I lived before we came here. So I'm quite glad that we've moved to Morton, because we can eat an Easter egg in one go. I remember my dad preaching on Easter Day once. It was a family service, what we now call all-age worship. And he had a big chocolate egg for the children to break into after the service. He was a firm believer in having a three-point sermon, usually with two sub-points for each point. And he always had a flip chart, because we didn't have screens then, and a very big marker pen to make his points with. You can see how big it is. This is one of his. I suppose at least you could gauge the length of a sermon if it had 6 points. This Easter Day, he had carefully constructed his points to spell out egg, E-G-G, that's what they started with. And it wasn't until afterwards, over Sunday lunch, as we were discussing the sermon, as you do, that my mum suddenly said, well, that's the first time I've seen egg spelt E-E-G. I think my dad tried to get out of it by saying that he was never any good at spelling. Anyway, I'm not going to go with 3 points this evening. How about 7? The 7 annoying things which crop up in this record of the resurrection appearance. Don't get me wrong, I'm not suggesting that the Bible is annoying. Far from it. But see what you make of these 7 annoying points as we look at the passage. The first one comes at the beginning in verse 13. That same day, two of them were going to a village called Emmaus. No names, no pack drill. Isn't it annoying? We have to read on to verse 18 before we find out that one of them was called Cleopas, but there's no detail about either, and we don't know the name of the other one. It's actually unclear even where Emmaus was. Nobody knows where it was. This is the longest account of a resurrection appearance. Mark gives this episode just 2 verses. But Luke, who seems keen on detail and accuracy, tells us almost nothing about these two. All that we know is that there were two of them, part of a wider group of disciples or followers who knew what had been going on. The betrayal and arrest of Jesus, the trial before the Jewish council, before Pilate, before Herod, the crucifixion, death, and burial. They might not have been present at all those events, but they'd caught up with those things from those who were. And they knew the latest. They knew about the women who'd gone to the tomb that same morning. So we can see that they were part of the inner group. And yet that's all that we know about them. How annoying. Second annoying thing. Jesus catches up with them and wants to know what they've been discussing. And then he professes to be unaware of it. What things, he asks in verse 19. Isn't it annoying when you have someone who isn't up to speed? And you have to start again from square one. I'm doing an online language course at the moment. There are about six of us in a Zoom class. And there's one lady who just, she doesn't do the homework. She doesn't learn the verbs and the nouns and the conjugations and the declensions. She will not learn the vocabulary. And so when the teacher says to her, "Right, Barbara, what does this word mean?" She has guesses at it, and the teacher then has to say, "Well, is it masculine? Is it feminine? Is it singular? Is it plural?" It's really annoying. It's really frustrating for the rest of us. These two can't quite understand how Jesus has missed everything. But they do give him quite a good summary, don't they, in verse 19. Jesus has come from Nazareth. Jesus is a prophet. He's powerful in word and deed. He was condemned and he was crucified. And then in verse 21, there's a bit of editorial addition. Have a look at that. We had hoped that he was the one who was going to redeem Israel. Had hoped sounds a bit final, doesn't it? It sounds like we had hoped, but we don't anymore. It's probably better translated as we were hoping. A bit more active and continuing. A faint flicker of hope not yet extinguished. And why did they use the phrase to redeem Israel? I think they were picking up on the very strong idea throughout the Old Testament and especially through the prophets that God would visit his people. He would comfort and redeem them. Do you remember Zechariah's song at the beginning of Luke? Blessed be the Lord God of Israel, for he has visited and redeemed his people. Remember that description of Simeon, also at the beginning of Luke. He was waiting for the consolation of Israel. These two had caught the right idea of hope. And yet they're reporting to Jesus, verses 22 and 24, of the empty tomb, the vision of angels, the declaration that Jesus was alive. Well, that was quite hopeless. It was without hope. Which brings us to the next annoying thing, verse 25. How annoying now for Jesus to realise that these two just haven't got it. All that he's taught them, all the Old Testament, all the signs, all the agony of the cross and separation from his Father, and yet these two disciples are foolish and slow of heart to believe. They're certain, you see, of the events of Good Friday. That's unsurprising, really, isn't it? Good Friday was very public, with crowds, Roman soldiers, an earthquake, tombs coming open, a curtain being torn in two, and yet they were far less certain about the resurrection. By contrast, in their minds, Jesus rising from the dead and being alive was at this stage merely a discounted rumour, an idle tale. Just have a look back at chapter 24 and verse 11. The women told the 11 what the angels had said, but their words seemed to them like nonsense. An idle tale. How annoying that would be for Jesus. Number four in the list of annoying things. And I think this is annoying for us, really, and I think it's the most frustrating. Jesus sets to and gives them a sermon, doesn't he? A very complete and helpful one. And yet we have no record of it. Isn't that annoying? Wouldn't it have been good at least to see some of the headings of that talk? Some of the main Old Testament references? Luke has recorded this incident, this appearance, in quite a lot of detail. All that reported speech, the times of day, the distances, and yet he hasn't thought to ask Cleopas for a transcript of the best sermon anyone could give on the Old Testament. We have a mere one verse, look at verse 27. And beginning with Moses and all the prophets, he explained to them what was said in all the scriptures concerning himself. Moses, representing the law and the prophets. The law and the prophets is a sort of shorthand phrase for the teaching of the Old Testament. Do you remember the transfiguration of Jesus up on the mountain, accompanied by Moses, representing the law, and Elijah, standing for all the prophets? I think we sometimes fall into the trap of assuming that the Old Testament law was not a good thing, too detailed, too difficult to keep, and didn't Jesus come to do away with it anyway? Well, the law was certainly detailed and comprehensive, and the Pharisees did add to it in ridiculous ways. But the law had been set out by God through Moses with a good purpose. It showed the Israelites how to live together in community, being blessed by God and being a blessing to the nations around. Do you remember when Moses had finished relaying God's laws and commands to the people? He gave them a choice. It's in Deuteronomy 30. I've set before you today life and good, or death and evil. And he warned the people that if they kept the law, they would live and prosper, but if they turned away from God, they would perish. So choose life, he urged, and the law was there to help them. Paul makes the point in Galatians that the Old Testament law was a guide. It was a guardian. It was like a school teacher to bring us to Christ. So the law and the prophets. I guess many of us could point to specific passages from the prophets which refer to the promise of a saviour. Perhaps from Isaiah, the virgin birth. Maybe we'd throw in Jonah, 3 days. Or perhaps Micah, foretelling of Bethlehem. Or Zechariah, Jesus entering Jerusalem on a donkey. But could we do that with all the prophets? These two disciples had a masterclass in an overview of the Old Testament from the person who knew it most intimately. But Luke doesn't record it. How annoying. Fifth annoying thing. Well, they only recognised Jesus when it was too late, didn't they? They'd invited him in, prevailed upon him to stay, started the meal, and he then, verse 30, took bread, gave thanks, broke it, and gave it to them. And only then did they recognise him. Or rather, only then were they allowed to recognise him. And then he disappeared. The two of them hadn't been at the Last Supper, but maybe they had seen the feeding of the 5,000. Maybe the feeding of the 4,000. Maybe they'd seen Jesus do the same actions with the bread in Galilee or Judea. But it was too late to ask any more questions or have any further conversation. The sixth annoying thing, and I'm sorry about this, but it's simply the fact that mobile phones, or any phones at all, hadn't been invented. There was no way of getting through to HQ in Jerusalem other than a second 7-mile walk. A walk probably in the dark, over hilly terrain, and when they were still tired from the first. But there wasn't any question of leaving it till the morning, was there? The news had to be told, and what good news it was. You don't need me to tell you how much things had changed for these two disciples. A faltering hope became hope personified. A partial understanding changed to full clarity. A deep sadness moved to hearts burning within them. And so, verse 33, they got up and returned at once to Jerusalem. And when they got there, they found, really annoying thing, they weren't the first with the news. It's always annoying, isn't it, when you're bursting with news and the person you've come to tell knows it already. These two had to wait and hear about Simon Peter's experience before they could tell anyone what had happened to them. I think that's properly annoying. So what do we make of this account from the first Easter day? I take three things from it. So you do get 3 points after all. First, Jesus appeared to two very ordinary disciples. So ordinary that we only know the name of one of them. They weren't part of the 11. They didn't become, as far as we know, leaders in the early church. We don't hear of them again. They were simply followers going home from Jerusalem to an obscure village. And yet Jesus chose, amongst all the other things he might have done, having just risen from the dead, he chose to spend time walking with them and explaining the scriptures. Jesus will meet with anyone, anywhere, and that includes us. We don't have to be special or well-known or part of an inner circle, and I think that's good news for us and for everyone. The second thing that I take from this passage is that it's all there in the Old Testament. The things concerning himself, verse 27. Jesus thought it was important that they should understand how it all pointed to him and how he fulfilled all the prophecies. And if it was important for them, then I think it must be important for us. I guess we need to read the Old Testament and study it and discover how all of it points to Jesus. And we have lots of aids, don't we? Books, commentaries, courses, podcasts, even sermons. We may be doing a sermon series soon on the so-called minor prophets. So come and get to grips with some of those shorter books towards the end of the Old Testament. Buy a commentary or two. Take something out of St. David's library at the back. Do you know, I never knew St. David's had a library until a few weeks ago. Let's be intentional about delving into the Old Testament as well as the New. And the third thing, I think, is that we need to pass on the message. And the message is exactly the same as the two disciples' message. The Lord is risen, he's alive, and he has appeared to us. It's always good to have a very short, 2-minute explanation ready about how we became a Christian, about how we understood the Easter message, about how Jesus appeared to us, so that we can pass it on when appropriate or when a question is asked. And that's all we have to do, pass on the news, because it's up to God to open people's eyes. Look at verse 31, and their eyes were opened and they recognized him. Jesus can and does appear to anyone, whatever walk of life they're in. And we can pass on the message to anyone, whatever they do and whatever they are. And what a glorious message it is. Jesus has risen, he's alive, and he has appeared to me. I think we're going to sing about it.